changing controversial street names, and rebuilding our cities for sea level rise. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Well, Hollywood city officials already voted to change three street names from Confederate generals' names to something else. But what should that something else be? We're going to discuss the options. Florida could look very different in the coming decades as the sea level continues to rise. We'll hear from an architect who will share his ideas on what our cities need to look like in order to handle more water. Then we'll meet Miguel Pilgrim, a South Florida man who won millions in the lottery. What's he doing with the money? Well, he's trying to help rebuild part of a neighborhood. We'll hear that story coming up. All of that today on Sundial here on WLRN. First, the news. Welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. There are three street names in Hollywood, Florida that are going to be changed. Now, street names are changed from time to time, but these have been at the center of a fight for years now. Why? Well, because they're named Lee, Hood, and Forrest. They're named after Confederate generals Robert E. Lee, John Bell Hood, and Nathan Bedford Forrest. Now, Forrest was an early leader of the KKK and is believed by many to have been the first so-called Grand Wizard. Well, the city voted in August to change the names as the debate about Confederate symbols intensified across the country over the past year. And the man who started this movement almost 15 years ago joins us now. His name is Benjamin Israel. Mr. Israel, do I have him there? Mr. Israel, are you there? Looks like I may have lost him. We'll see if we can get him back as quickly as possible. While we wait to do that, I want to turn things over to the mayor of Hollywood, Mr. Josh Levy. Mr. Levy, Mayor Levy, how are you doing today?
Good. Good afternoon.
Thank you so much for joining us. Well, first of all, you just jumped into office not that long ago. It was last year. And so you already knew about this fight. You knew about what was coming. Really, what were you thinking about with this issue as you were coming into office?
So look, certainly I was engaged with the city's civic issues prior to being elected, and this, like you said, was an issue that was at the forefront of repeated comments and requests from persons like Benjamin Israel and other residents who were really impressing upon the consciousness of the city, its moral compass, so to speak, to say, hey, our city stands for much better than this. We can't stand by and have streets named after persons whose main objective in their role in U.S. history was to try to further the institution of slavery, and that the city should, for the sake of our own identity, be proud to remove those names and change them.
Now, you've spoken to and you've heard from residents in your community who didn't want the changes, right? What did you hear from them? What were they telling you?
So the main issue was, of course, the folks that happen to live on those three streets, about 1,500 residents and businesses that would be affected from a street name change, who would have to, if you're a resident, get your driver's license renewed with a new change of address and go through the inconvenience of changing your address for purposes of mail, and, of course, a business that would have to do the same. Mostly out of the inconvenience, although some folks, of course, said, hey, history is history, and these names didn't bother anyone for 90 years, and why should we start now?
And what about that side of the argument? Because we've seen this and heard this throughout the South when it comes to debating statues or anything that's linked to the Confederacy. There are people who will argue, have argued, well, it's history, and you're not going to remove the history, are you?
Right. So I think there's a difference between history as we know it, which is to be found in, for example, history books and museums, and to be learned as we often learn history. But you don't teach history, and people don't get their history from street signs. And so I personally, and the majority of the city commission here in the end, of course, we understood that to have a street named after you is an honor as opposed to a history lesson. And the city has its choices as to who it feels it should honor. In Hollywood, we felt like there's no need to honor those who tried to further the institution of slavery.
All right, I want to turn things over now real quickly because I do believe that I have Mr. Israel now joining us. Benjamin Israel, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I appreciate it. You moved to Hollywood, Florida back in 1979, right?
That's not completely correct. I was in Opa-locka at 1979, a New Yorker, and a year and a half later, I was in Hollywood.
Okay. When you moved to Hollywood, were you in that Liberia neighborhood where the streets are located?
No, I was not in that area. I've never lived in that area.
Okay.
And it's one of the points that some of the commissioners tried to make, that I don't live in that area, so what's my concern? And they also tried to make it into a racial issue. These people, as I just heard the mayor so eloquently point out, these people try. Not only did they want to extend slavery, but they wanted to destroy the United States as it existed.
And
you know, so where's the patriotism?
And again, you're talking about the Confederate generals, and that
I'm talking about the Confederacy in general.
Right.
That was what they were about, to destroy the United States of America as it was known.
So. You didn't live on these streets, but you started this fight almost 15 years ago. Why did you want the names changed back then?
Well, let me make a little correction here. I was a catalyst. There's no question about that. But if it hadn't been for Professor Barry Sakharov at that time, I would not have known anything about it. I was serving at that time on something called the African American Advisory Council, which I served on for 6 fruitless years. Barry Sakharov, he came to me and gave me an article from the Miami Herald pointing this matter out. And I took it back to the African American Advisory Council and told them that we had to do something about it. And they looked at me like I had 10 heads.
Well, no. I mean, because as you said, that you had members on the council who were arguing, well, you don't even live there. Why is he fighting for this? What was your response to that?
My response for that is that I'm an American citizen. And to have a street anywhere in the United States of America named after anybody who was part of the Confederacy that was responsible for the death of over 650,000 living Americans, most of whom were white, that's an untenable situation.
This area, this part of the community where these street names exist, Liberia, has historically been at the heart of a prominent African-American community in Hollywood. Were you able ever to find out why the city gave those streets those names?
No, I can only surmise. To this day, not much respect is given to the black psyche. I noticed here just recently that Justin Timberlake is going to star at the Super Bowl. Now, he was at the Super Bowl with a black woman by the name of Janet Jackson, and he ripped her clothing and exposed her breasts, and she was held accountable for it. He wasn't held accountable for it at all. And I'm sure that if Usher had been there with, Britney Spears, and he had done the same thing to Britney Spears, Britney Spears would not have been the fall girl. That's the way America is.
When you started fighting for this, and again, this is some time ago now, what were people telling you back then?
Well, they were telling me I was crazy, forget about it, I was wasting my time. And I mean people who I had great respect for. You know, but I couldn't abide that. You know, I don't see any street in white neighborhoods named after Ted Bundy. You know, these people were responsible for almost a million people being slaughtered, and they should be honored. That's ridiculous. John Brown, who went against the government, he wasn't trying to take the government over. They arrested him. They put him on trial. He was convicted and hung. You know. But these guys were given a pat on the head because they signed an amnesty agreement, and he went right out, Forrest did, and formed the Ku Klux Klan.
What kept you going? Because, I mean, again, it's taken 15 years.
I don't know. I can't tell you what kept me going, but I was raised a certain way. I'm an Orthodox Jew, and there is a term from the Mishnah that says, Lefum Sa'ara Agra, which means according to the effort, so is the reward. So if you want something change, you have to have focus, you got to have commitment, and you got to have perseverance.
All right,
that kept me going.
I want to come back over to the mayor real quickly, and I want to ask him, Mayor Levy, now that the names are being changed, I wanted to know where the ideas came from, because now we're looking at three potential names, and really, how did you come to those names? And not everybody's happy with that change, by the way.
So the three replacement names would be that Forest would become Freedom Street, Lee would become Liberty Street, and Hood Street would become Hope Street. So Liberty, Hope, and Freedom. And I think any American hearing the words Liberty, Hope, and Freedom understands those ideals that are the core values of what makes and what was the core values of this country was founded upon. And I think they're pointed that they actually also express the reason, perhaps, the why. They answer the question, why bother changing the names? It's because we believe in the freedom, the hope, and the liberty for all, including African-Americans and every other persuasion in this country. That's what this country stands for, and it's also what those Confederate generals, fought to not allow. And so it also, I think we chose those names because it also starts with the same first letter, in which case it might be a little less foreign to those living on the street. It maybe make the transition a little easier the identity sort of not as difficult to replace.
Well, you've heard from some neighbors and activists who think those names are way too abstract. They want names that honor individuals important to the history of the Liberia community. What would be wrong with that?
So, first of all, these streets also run in other neighborhoods. It's not only in Liberia. They go all the way to the western boundaries of the city. And there was not an overwhelming number of folks who felt like the only way to replace these names was to replace the names with, civil rights or folks involved in the great legacy of the African-American community here in the United States. So, sure, there were a lot of opinions. A lot of folks felt like perhaps we should just continue the Hollywood nomenclature for streets with continuing the names of U.S. presidents, which we have. Most of our streets are U.S. president names. From Washington to Cleveland and on. And so there were a lot of opinions. A lot of folks wanted to continue, for example, names of trees and flowers, which we have in the city. And in fact, in the Liberia Flat, the original flat that Mr. Israel knows well, there were streets, the avenues were originally called Pine and Oak. And so some folks pointed to that, but those streets, street names were already taken up in other parts of the city. So,
okay.
Look, in the end, you can't satisfy every desire for every particular name. We found three names that we liked, and I think those will be the names once the resolution is adopted later in November.
All right. You know what? Let me bring in back in Mr. Israel. Mr. Israel, first of all, do you feel at all any vindication of the fact that you had a lot of young folks, young activists, who took up this fight and pushing for this change as well?
Yes, it was gratifying because, as I said earlier, when I took this to the African American Advisory Council, of which I was a member, this is back in 2002, not one of them were concerned enough to get involved. So it was gratifying to see these young people who, before they made their appearance at City Hall, I didn't even know them. So that was very gratifying. It was also gratifying once we had a change of leadership at City Hall, to see that the new mayor, Mayor Levy, hit the ground running, letting it be known that this was not a racial issue, that this was something that had to be done. These people did not deserve to be honored in any way, shape, form, or fashion.
What did you think about the fact that one of the groups really that took the lead these last few years is the Black Lives Matters group, and have you worked with them?
I have worked with them. I'm not a party to their group. I let them know for me personally, I'm not into and never have been into that when I was their age, back during the time of the King era, I'm not for demonstration. You know, no, I don't know of any other ethnic group in this country, whether it was the Irish, the Jewish, the Italians, even the Vietnamese. I don't know any of them who had to demonstrate in order to get their rights. Their rights came via citizenship under the Constitution. But when it comes to blacks, there's a whole different thing. So black lives does matter, though I'm not part of their group per se. But anytime I can work with them as they have worked with us, I won't have any problem whatsoever doing that.
What do you think about these new names that they've pitched, Liberty, Hope, and Freedom?
I don't have a problem with them at all. They're not Forrest, they're not Lee, and they're not Hood. I mean, there were some of the commissioners who wanted to maintain the names, just Lee Harper, for instance, who wrote Killer Mockingbird. You know, if you change, leave it Lee, make it Harper, not Lee.
Mayor,
that's my opinion on that.
Yeah, Mayor Levy, so really, where are we in the process now? When is the final vote on these name changes?
So we, of course, last week had a workshop where we sort of formed a consensus on what the replacement names would be. Now I believe the process requires the city have one more meeting to adopt a resolution to effectuate these name changes in an official permanent way. And there's, of course, going to be notice to the affected folks and an advertised meeting. So one more meeting, I believe, is all we need, is a resolution to be adopted by the Hollywood City Commission. I expect it to be sometime in November, most likely the second meeting in November.
But again, just coming back to this, you know, I'm just curious as to your thoughts about renaming those streets after abolitionist Harriet Tubman or Sojourner Truth.
So look, those iconic folks certainly deserve street names in their honor, and they would be considered just like any others. We just didn't feel at this point in time, given I think especially also the, you know, the emotions involved, that we were going to go in that complete opposite direction.
But why not? Why not, Mayor Levy?
Well, look, I think Hope, Freedom, and Liberty totally go to that direction, and they also make it an easy transition with keeping the same first letter. Again, there's not only one way to handle it, and we found our way where we formed a consensus, and I'm happy with it, just like Benjamin Israel is.
Again, we've been talking about the controversial debate that has been going on for years now in Hollywood, Florida. Three street names named after Confederate generals, Robert E. Lee, John Bell Hood, and Nathan Bedford Forrest. Those will be changing. And again, the new names that have been pitched are Liberty, Hope, and Freedom. Again, as we've heard from Hollywood Mayor Josh Levy, that's in an upcoming meeting. We also heard from Benjamin Israel, who really helped start this fight almost 15 years ago. Mr. Israel, I really appreciate your time. And Mayor Levy, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, coming up next, well, seas are rising. But how are we going to think about the way we build and expand our cities? We're going to talk to an architect who's got some ideas. That's coming up next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Well, imagine South Florida in 20 years. Okay, let's say 40 years. What do you think it's going to look like? Well, the population's likely going to double, and that means more high-rises and houses for all those people. Hopefully, we're going to resolve the transportation issue because, well, traffic's already terrible. And what will our cities and communities look like if the ocean is rising? Are we going to have to abandon certain areas, or are we just going to have to build on water? Our next guest is an architect and teaches architecture at Florida Atlantic University. Tony Abate is also the FAU Associate Provost and Director of the FAU School of Architecture. And he says the time is coming. We're going to have to learn to live with water more so than we already do. And it's just going to become a greater part of our lives. Tony Abate, it's a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Luis.
All right. You know what? I was curious. As an architect, you think about South Florida and the way we've built our cities, the way we've planned our communities. I'm wondering, first, what is it that you see that you like and you think, that's great, good idea? And what do you see that is just probably chewing away at you like, oh, that is terrible?
That's a great question. I have to say what I see that I like is the amount of energy and effort expended in redevelopment. I think that bodes well for the future because we're not afraid to reinvent ourselves and rebuild. We've already erased the past about three times in South Florida and built from scratch. So I think that attitude is what it's going to take to envision a new future. What I don't like is maybe our overdependence on the automobile, let's say, because that distributed network of roadways and highways and property extended well into the landscape makes it really challenging to address issues such as sea level rise.
All right. Now, you teach architecture, but you also spend time talking with city leaders. So I'm curious as to, you know, how that conversation goes with the students compared to the communities and city leaders when you say, listen, the future's as the future comes, we're going to have to learn to live more with water than we already do. And, you know, really, how do you get that across? And I wonder what people even think, what they say back to you.
Well, I think what's interesting is that when it comes to the city leaders and the local political landscape, it's actually quite progressive. And I think South Florida has distinguished itself nationwide, and if not around the world, for that action-oriented attitude. I think the local governments are taking action. The counties from Monroe all the way to Palm Beach have formed a group called the Southeast Florida Regional Climate Compact. And within that compact, they've actually put together a number of priorities and strategies for addressing sea level rise in communities across the region from Key West to Delray Beach. I think politically, both locally as well as nationally, our elected representatives in Congress are poised to take this issue further. And I think a lot of it just stems from the fact that they're probably getting a lot of phone calls every time we have a king tide or a flood event. This is real for us. This is not something abstract.
I know you brought up politics, and I want to ask about that. But before we get to that point, though, I want to come back to this idea. Is what do you mean by, and when I hear anybody say that in the future, we're just going to have to learn to live with water more. What does that mean exactly? I'm trying to picture our you know, we so many people live in Florida live near the coast because we want that waterfront property. But all of a sudden now, what, when we think of sea level rise, that may be more than just waterfront property, you know, in the decades to come.
Yes, I think living with water means exactly that. There are different ways to live with water. We have to think about where the water is coming from, where the water is situated. It's one thing to really think conventionally, which is our relationship to the water has been sitting on dry land, gazing across a body of water. And another to actually think about that water on the land or on the property. And I think there are different approaches to this. One can envision, let's say, a 21st century version of Venice, Italy. One can envision cities on the water. These, of course, are big challenges because they're very transformative ideas. They're not based on convention. They're not based on anything we currently do or know how to do, at least from a policy perspective or legal perspective. I think we're working on it. We're investigating it. But living with the water means different things. This is a gradual process. Certainly there are areas that are inundated now due to tidal fluctuations, and they're experiencing these ebbs and flows of water on their properties. Adapting to that in the short term is probably the first step. Longer term, we may have to look at areas that may be permanently inundated that we may have to abandon, as well as areas that are high and dry that we may need to migrate to and increase densities, along with making connections between them, and that speaks to transportation. So our transportation planning really has to include sea level adaptation.
Did you just say there are areas we may have to abandon?
Yes.
How do you convince city leaders and more than that developers in an area that is so rich? No, we can't build there anymore. We have to get out. That is a lot of money you're talking about that we have to walk away from.
That's a problem. But I do believe that the region is preparing itself for that. from a planning perspective as well as a legal perspective, there are tools and policies to provide transfer of development rights, for example, assemble the property rights of a group or a neighborhood and assign it to a new area. There are different solutions. But, of course, when we say abandon, these are very specific areas that are very challenged.
Can you think of one area that you think about that might be?
Well, it's hard to say, but if you currently experience flooding on a dry day, it's likely you're among those areas that are most vulnerable. So the highest risk areas are those that are currently experiencing flooding on a regular basis in the absence of rain, let's say.
And that's parts of Miami Beach.
Parts of
Fort Lauderdale.
Parts of Fort Lauderdale, parts of western Miami-Dade County and Broward County.
So what does the future look like for then communities like this? I mean, what do you imagine if we're talking about 20, 40 years from now? You know, are you saying that some of these communities we may have to abandon or that we can build our way through this?
It's possible. I think that over the years, we've learned that there are many solutions. But as an architect, I can design a solution, or any of our students can design solutions. The issue is the policies the codification, the codes, the regulations, everything that we have at our disposal that regulates the development industry and design industries need to adjust, need to accommodate transformative ideas. It could be as simple as amphibious vehicles in some areas, designing your foundations to...
Wait. When you say amphibious, look, are we saying at any point that we're going to have neighborhoods that look like Venice and the only way around is boats?
I would say that why not? We may have to envision that. As long as we intend to keep the urban form that we currently live under, unless we want to have a wholesale transformation, it's likely that some areas are going to have to deal with the stresses of sea level rise in a more immediate way than others.
So you look at Miami Beach, and they're spending hundreds of millions of dollars on this pumping system to try to reroute water. Obviously, there have always been conversations, and there are seawalls, but conversations about bigger seawalls. Those things aren't solutions. Those things can't help solve the problem.
They are solutions. The question is now for how long? How long do these systems last? To what levels of sea level rise have they been designed to? The problem we have here is not merely holding back the ocean. A lot of people may think that sea level rise is a coastal phenomenon. But in fact, water in South Florida is coming at us from all directions. The impact of global warming is manifesting itself in intense rainfalls, intense storm activities, as well as rising seas that are the result of glacial and ice sheet melt. What's unique about our region, and also the opportunity embedded in that region, is the idea that we live on a very porous limestone base, and that porous limestone is what feeds the aquifer. So every time it rains, the water percolates through the land down into the aquifer and provides a fresh water source. But the reverse is true. As the water pressures rise through rising seas and flooding, that aquifer gets filled up, and it reaches a point of saturation where then we begin to see water present on the ground and above the ground. That means that we're getting water from all directions.
Yeah, it's not just coming from the ocean.
Correct.
As you said. Again, I'm talking with Tony Abate. He is the FAU Associate Provost and Director of the FAU School of Architecture. And we're talking about this idea that as the seas rise, well, we may have to rethink how we are redeveloping our communities to deal with that, and the fact that we're just going to have to live with more water in the future. We'll continue this conversation on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial here on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez, joined in studio with Tony Abate. He is the director of the FAU School of Architecture. We've been talking about this idea that as the sea level rises, and again, it'll take decades, probably by the end of the century. We don't know what South Florida could look like, but we have to start thinking about how we replan our cities, because we're going to, as we've been talking about, have to learn to live with more water. So just think about king tides. Think about when those heavy rains come and all that flooding. It's probably going to get worse. Tony Abate, wanted to ask you about, it's called the Salty Urban Project, right?
Salty urbanism.
Or urbanism. Thank you. Okay. Salty urbanism. First of all, how do you define that? What is that exactly? I was reading the report, but you know, I'm trying to think, how do you define this?
Actually, this was a brainchild of one of our faculty, Jeffrey Huber, who we're very proud to have on our faculty, and he's been working with other faculty as well as students on this project. It was really the culmination of some research done through a Florida Sea Grant, which is a partnership of the Florida Board of Education and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, to look at adaptation strategies in the coastal areas. And so working with the city of Fort Lauderdale in their North Beach neighborhood, they examined buildings, city blocks, and the neighborhood to find ways to think about how we manage water and increasing amounts of water. And what's interesting about salty urbanism is that the idea is that water exists in three phases, but what we're trying to do is use plant material as infrastructure. So trees that are highly absorptive, that can absorb at a very rapid rate gallons and gallons and gallons of water, to provide that ecosystem service to absorb water and then transfer it from land to atmosphere by evaporation, transpiration. It's a really interesting concept, a way to remediate water on sites, whether from flooding or heavy rains. And it's become kind of a framework for adapting that area of North Beach, Fort Lauderdale, and replacing essentially the pavements and the piped storm drainage system with plant materials that absorb water that live in wet environments.
Can you tell me what kind of trees are best for this?
Oh, gosh. There are a number of trees. I don't have the names of the trees specifically, but I know that, for example, one of them that is not on the list, but this is the tree that was brought from Australia to drain the Everglades. I think it was Napoleon Bonaparte Broward that actually brought these trees in.
So invasive trees might actually help us?
There are native trees that can help us as well,
All right.
That are very absorptive, that can absorb very vast rates of water. I don't have the name of the tree, unfortunately.
So, I mean, it's not to say that, you know, yes, we do have a lot of area that's been paved over,
mm-hmm.
but we do have a lot of trees here as well. So, but it's about finding the right types of trees.
The right types of trees and planting them strategically to absorb that water. As well as plant material.
That in of itself, could that do enough to help deal with flooding?
It's part of a larger solution, and I think it's a very realistic way to look at this. We're really trying to find as many possible ways to store water. Right now, we drain water off of our roofs onto the site and into the storm drainage system. Some of it percolates into the ground. But I think if we manage to find ways to store water on site, whether on our buildings, in our buildings, and then find ways to transfer that water, we're at least able to survive these flood events that happen periodically.
Can you tell us about any particular city or country, region of the world, that may teach us something? Because, I mean, I know you said that a lot of people are watching South Florida and how we deal with this problem, but is there anybody else who's already ahead of us?
Well, I would say that a lot of people are looking at Holland. The Netherlands has, for centuries, been dealing with water. Unfortunately for us, our geological structure is quite different than theirs, so they're able to build dikes and dams and polders and ways to manage water. Some of that knowledge could transfer, but it would rely a lot on mechanical pumps to keep that pressure differential, to keep the water and off of our sites. So as much as the Netherlands provides a lot of very interesting solutions, they don't necessarily apply to us. The opportunity here, though, is that if we can find these solutions that work for us, there are lots of areas around the world that have similar problems as we do. We can become the exporters of that knowledge, and it becomes a great economic opportunity for us if we're able to solve it.
Do we have the political will to do that here?
I think we do. I think it's growing, you know, at least at a local level.
But is that enough? Because you know what? I mean, look, we have folks in Tallahassee who are not thinking about it as much. Granted, they don't live, a lot of them don't live down here in South Florida, so they may not be experiencing some of this. It's not to say flooding issues are increasing in many different parts, but I mean, we do have an administration that has been, you know, embroiled in a controversy on just even saying the word climate change. I mean, is there really the political will on all levels to start working on the problem? It's not debating climate change. It's just saying the seas are rising and we need to start working on this now.
I think across the political spectrum, at least in my, it's been my experience, that as long as we don't get into these arguments about the cause of sea level rise, and we're actually focused now on the problem and how to solve it, you're going to find consensus. These are real problems. They're affecting people in real ways, and the economic impact of not doing anything has been demonstrated to far outweigh the cost of doing something. I think the fact that we've created the Southeast Florida Regional Climate Compact that brings together such a large region, well over 7.5 million people, adds a lot of clout to this. In fact, we can compete effectively with other states for funding to address the issue locally. We're sitting on well over $1 trillion worth of value here that we can't just turn away from.
As we look forward into the future, is it a matter of rebuilding our cities, you know, putting more buildings with? I mean, because, again, looking through this, I was kind of taken back with some of the stuff that I'd seen in the research that, I mean, in some cases, you may have to put homes or structures on some kind of stilt or platform to raise it. We may have to raise streets, or we just have to rethink how we rebuild homes and buildings so that they can, you know, withstand flooding much better than they are now. But is it a matter of we have to rebuild our cities, or can we just kind of replan them and move things around, or, you know, again, find a way to manipulate the water?
Again, a good question, but I think the answer is a combination of things. As I said earlier, we have a history of transforming ourselves. We've transformed ourselves several times. I was born and raised in South Florida, and the history of this place is fascinating in that we originated as a swamp, a slough, a very waterborne environment. In fact, the earliest homes in Fort Lauderdale were water-oriented, and the only way to get around was by boat. Flagler's Railroad transformed that, and then the automobile transformed it again. We're looking at another transformation. So transformation is not the same as resiliency. Resiliency is about bouncing back from a stress condition to what you have originally. Transformation is really a change in a fundamental way. So there will be areas of South Florida that will transform if we're going to tackle this issue properly. And then there are areas that probably won't transform as much. They'll adapt. But it is a combination, and it's all tied to the land, to the landscape. What we've done over the past 150 years is pretty much cosmetic surgery, but nature remembers where the rivers ran, and I think eventually we're going to be confronting that reality as the waters rise.
Tony Abate, again, director of the FAU School of Architecture, talking to us about really what we need to be thinking about in our communities as we move forward in the future and dealing with sea level rise and the fact that, again, we may be living with a lot more water in the future. Mr. Abate, it's been a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Luis.
All right, coming up, we're going to meet a man who won the Florida lottery. What's he doing with the money? He's helping to rebuild a neighborhood. We'll hear that story coming up next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial here on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. All right, so it was 2010 when Miguel Pilgrim bought a ticket, a Quick Pick lotto ticket, and it was a winner, $52 million. Now, if you won that much money, what would you do? Honestly, think about that. What would you do with that money? Well, you know what he's doing? He wants to use it to help rebuild a portion of Sistrunk Boulevard. And that's a portion recognized in Broward County as the historical heartbeat of Fort Lauderdale's oldest black community. This is a community that once thrived, and not so much. And he has big plans, and civic leaders are excited about the possibilities. And we're joined now by Mr. Pilgrim. He's joining me here in studio. It's such a pleasure. Thanks so much for joining us today.
I appreciate it. Thanks, Lewis.
You know what? First of all, take us back to that day, and you found out you won. And I think I had read that you thought you won $52,000, and somebody said, no, you won $52 million.
Absolutely. The level of excitement jumped dramatically once I realized that it wasn't $52,000. The gas station attendant actually was more excited than I was.
That's got to be overwhelming, though. That's a lot of money.
I think it was an opportunity to grow.
All right, so when it happens, what's the first thing that you do? What did you do?
I'm military trained, so I took a different perspective than most people to prepare myself for what I knew was to come or what I expected to come. You can never really plan these things out strategically, but I do start the plan. And that was make a few phone calls, verify a few things, get some things in order before I made the trip to Tallahassee.
You know, I had read about the lottery curse.
Mm-hmm.
And look, this isn't scientifically proven, but there have just been so many stories of people. They win these big jackpots, mm-hmm. and you think their life's going to be better, and then mm-hmm. everything gets worse.
Absolutely.
And so many of them file bankruptcy within a few years.
Mm-hmm.
What is it that helped you not just handle all this big life change, but you're thriving with it?
I think a big part of that is a plan. Before I went to verify the ticket, I jotted down a plan, and I've always expected certain things to happen into my life, and it was just part of my plan. I just had more resources to execute the plan with a sense of urgency rather than planning 4 or 5 years. I can do it immediately. So the things that I decided to do were already laid out. I'd visualized them for years. It was just a matter of getting more details and executing.
You talk about your military experience in Navy, right?
Mm-hmm. Four generations.
You had another life-changing experience when you were, what, 20?
Mm-hmm.
You were trying to help somebody.
Oh, it was in my 20s, my late
20s. In your 20s. Okay, mm-hmm. In your late 20s. You were trying to help somebody who was in trouble. They were being attacked.
Yes, he was being robbed.
And you jumped in to help, and then all of a sudden you find yourself in danger. Somebody shot at you.
Yeah, I took a bullet.
What happened then?
I have a skill set that's very unique back then, and that was a high level of protection and assets. And when I saw this guy, it was just reaction. I knew he was getting robbed. I knew what was happening to him. So I pulled over, got out of the car to address the issue, but I didn't. The threat assessment wasn't done as accurately as I could have done. And when he ran away, I was going to stop, but the guy said he had his wallet. So I was like, okay, let me give this guy a chase. And he took some fast steps. I'm a pretty fast guy. He turned around so quickly that the best I could do was kind of turn my body at an angle to create a smaller target. And I think that saved my life.
But that in of itself, what does that kind of experience do to you and shape you in the man that you are?
Discipline. There's nothing that can't be done. I don't believe in impossible. The word can't is something that myself and my team don't believe in. And just stay disciplined. Execute the plan. Tweak it as needed. And success is inevitable.
Let's go to what you're trying to do now. And again, as I mentioned, it's a part of Sistrunk Boulevard in a community that you're trying to help rebuild. For people who've never been there, first of all, mm-hmm. describe this one stretch of street that you want to try to change.
Sistrunk Boulevard, I'm not from the area, but it reminds me of a place that I grew up in, Memphis. And because nobody was there to help them preserve that historical culture, it no longer exists. And I saw that coming here. All the indicators are here. Somebody has to step in and challenge the city as well as the citizens of that area that this is historic. We have to, if we have the resources, and we have the resources, but I can't champion it alone. And these are pioneers on a whole nother level.
What are some of the things, when you talk about historic, just for, again, people who don't know the community, what are some of those things mm-hmm. that historically were a part of that community no longer there?
One of the first surgeons, one of the first grocery stores, the first libraries, first dental offices. And I'm not even scratching the surface. This is what I've heard from so many people. I actually have just closed a deal with one of the families, the Mizell, Pappy, and Mosby family for another piece over there. And they have so much history. It's amazing.
What happened, and probably goes to what happened in the community you're talking about in Memphis.
Mm-hmm.
What happened that all of that just disappeared? I wonder what you hear from people.
Yeah. Everybody has a different take on it as to why not, what's happened and why that area hasn't maintained the affluence of many other areas. And I have my own take on it, but I will say this, I believe for a fact is it's a combination of resources. It's also a combination of having a vision. You know, we have this historical platform. We have this historical location in the city. How do we preserve it, yet keep it affluent and keep it up to date with the other areas? How does it grow with the city? I think that's the biggest challenge. We have a historical area. And then who maintains that? Who champions that?
Do you think it has to be the local government, or does it have to be someone like you to come along and say, you know what, I'm going to bring this back?
I think it's all those things. I think it's somebody who can see the historical value. I think it's the local citizens. I think it's the local government. I think all those, it has to be a team. One entity can't preserve. It has to be cooperation with everybody involved.
What are your plans? What is it that you want to bring to this area? And again, we're talking about really just a couple blocks, mm-hmm. right? It's a small little part of the street, though.
Absolutely. Well, Pilgrim Group is a real estate company.
Yeah.
Family-owned entrepreneurship, and there are very, very different parts to that company. One is acquisition of real estate, management, renovation, development, hard money lending. But for the Sistrunk area, it's close to what I'm doing downtown. We're opening a jazz lounge as well as a restaurant. And I want to take that same concept on the history. What this place is, it used to be a restaurant. We bought it from the Hill family right there at 15th and 1448 Northwest Sistrunk. And I'm going to turn it into an open-air restaurant on the first floor, a blues lounge. And that's collaboration with the one across the street, the deal I just closed for the Mizell family. And I want to put retail on the bottom there. And right to, next to the new YMCA that's coming, I want to have a performing arts center on the second story and possibly some micro units for residents on the third story. I haven't planned out that far, but I think with that sort of venue, a performing arts center that has dance, music, art, how does that not bring culture? And then you have to fund that. With the retail aspect on the first floor, you bring a bank, Starbucks, Jamba Juice, and all this complements the YMCA next door.
How do you, whenever somebody comes into any neighborhoods that either have been blighted or abandoned or mm-hmm. forgotten, mm-hmm. there's always the fear mm-hmm. of gentrification.
Yes.
So how are you, you know, making that promise to the community and to civic leaders that that's not going to necessarily happen, that you're trying to rebuild this neighborhood, but that it's not going to just fall in the hands of gentrification, which then, of course, leads to property values go up and a lot of people end up getting shoved out of the community.
Absolutely. There is no guarantee in anything. But because I've seen this happen where I come from, there's a personal commitment that I have to the community. Not only am I just speaking that I'm going to do this, I'm putting my money where my mouth is, on a large sum of money. It's not like I want to flip, because you can't really flip property in that area. You have to have a long-term vision. And that's my goal, a long-term vision. And they'll see the stages. They'll see what I'm doing with each property individually, and they'll see progressively there's a greater commitment.
How long is it going to take?
I think we're starting 2018 for the first property that used to be the Hill and across the street. I think mid-2018. We're working with the city on some wonderful incentives. They're helping us out there, so they're really committed to this. It'll work.
Again, Miguel Pilgrim, trying to change one community at a time. He's starting with this one little part of Sistrunk Boulevard. And you know what? It's a story we want to keep up with. We want to follow up with you and see how things turn out. I really appreciate you coming in and sharing the story with us.
Well, Lewis, it's always a pleasure. I definitely appreciate you having me.
And that is the end of the program for today, Monday, October 23rd. Thanks again for listening. I'm Lewis Hernandez. Talk to you tomorrow.